Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half as I bring you yet again an interesting mix of discussion on science, faith, belief, the Bible and much more besides. I'll be introducing my guests in just a moment's time. This is the show that aims to get Christians thinking and you can find, of course, many past shows in the archives if you visit the website of Unbelievable. That's premier.org.uk/Unbelievable, and there's also lots of features and other resources if you want to browse through there. Oftentimes we're doing discussions between Christians and non-Christians, but today on the show I'm joined by two Christian guests. It's an area of faith and belief that often comes up in one form or another on the show. So today we're doing the first of two programs looking at young earth creationism and evolution, and my guests today are Andy McIntosh and Robert Asher. Let me introduce you to them.
You're unbelievable.
Well, Andy McIntosh is a professor of thermodynamics and combustion theory at the University of Leeds. He's a leading British young earth creationist, often writes and speaks for organisations such as Answers in Genesis. Recent books include Origins, Examining the Evidence. Our other guest today is Robert Asher, a paleontologist and curator at the Museum of Zoology in Cambridge. He's the author of a new book, Evolution and Belief, Confessions of a Religious Paleontologist. We'll ask him about that in a moment's time. As a Christian, he sees no conflict between the evolutionary account of life and his faith. So those are our guests on the programme today. It's great to have two gentlemen who know what they're talking about in their various fields. Because today on the show, our first question that we're going to be tackling as we look ahead to two shows on this issue is, does the rock and fossil record speak of Noah's flood or evolution? That's what we're going to be looking at on the show today. So a very warm welcome, gentlemen, to you both. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with me.
Great to be with you, Justin.
Let's come to you first of all, Robert, as we've never had you on the show before. You're not from the UK originally, are you? Would you like to tell us a bit of your background?
Yes, so you're absolutely correct. I am not from the UK. I grew up in the western part of New York State near Buffalo, and I've been in the UK for about 6.5 years. What else can I tell you? I have been a tax-paying European now. I feel a bit self-conscious saying that here in the UK because I, from a purely outsider's unbiased perspective, never quite know if I'm in the EU here or not. But anyways, I've lived in the EU for about a bit over 10 years now, six of which have been in this lovely country.
So tell us about, firstly, Christian faith. Has that been something that's been part of your life a long time?
It has. So it, you know, like many people, it has waxed and waned over the years. I my dad's Jewish, my mom's Presbyterian. I was raised, I think, via purely pragmatic grounds in a Presbyterian church in Western New York. I had a more evangelical phase in late high school, early college. I currently attend Evensong more often during term than not at various colleges at my university. And insofar as I view Christ as an object of worship, I am a Christian.
Mm. So tell us a bit about the scientific background then. Your work as a paleontologist, which is the fancy word for a person who looks at fossils, sure, and dinosaurs and that kind of thing, has taken you all over the world, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty standard in the field. I mean, I don't really stand out compared to my colleagues in that regard. But so I did my PhD in New York in the 90s and finished in 2000. And my focus was actually on a group of living mammals. So my focus overall is on mammalian biology and, as you say, paleontology. And the group I focused on for my PhD were Tenrex. They're a fairly diverse group, most common on the island of Madagascar. And paleontology plays into the equation largely for accidental reasons. Extinction is something that's happened many, many times over the course of Earth history. And paleontology is sort of a subset within biology driven essentially by this accident of extinction. So my current job is actually within a department of zoology, and I am one of actually very few people in that department who are particularly interested in extinct animals.
Mm. Mm. And this new book that came out, I think, last year, the Evolution and Belief, Confessions of a Religious Paleontologist. What sort of confessions are going on in that kind of a book?
Well, so the vast majority of the book is making the case that this mechanism that Charles Darwin articulated 150 years ago and that has been greatly refined since then is the major explanation as to how biodiversity has come to exist as we see it today. The confession, I guess, is a somewhat of a way to convey the book to a general public, in the sense that due to the accident, I think, that the world's most famous atheist happens to be an evolutionary biologist. I think Richard Dawkins could have been a chemist or an engineer or something, but for whatever historical reasons, he's an evolutionary biologist. A lot of my friends and colleagues and family members believe or have come to the impression that I'm sure we'll discuss in great detail in the next hour or so, that evolutionary biology is fundamentally atheistic. Mm. And I guess my confession is that I don't think that's true. And my faith in Christianity is, you know, anecdotal evidence for that. And of course, I'm one of a large number of people who do hold religious beliefs of one kind or another. Sure. And see no problem integrating that into a contemporary mainstream scientific worldview.
Well, we look forward to this engagement that you have on today's program. Our other guest, as I mentioned, is Andy McIntosh, Professor of Thermodynamics and Combustion Theory at the University of Leeds, a leading young Earth creationist here in Britain, and of course joined us for a special live debate that was aired on this show last year between himself and Hugh Ross on the Age of the Earth. A very popular show that was too, Andy, so obviously lots of people engaged and interested in this whole area. But for those who aren't perhaps familiar with you, you want to give us a little potted history of your background, faith-wise and scientifically.
Yeah, thanks, Justin, and I appreciate being asked to come back on the programme. I've been a Christian since 1969, when I understood for the first time that Christ had died on the cross and risen again, not just sort of generally, but that it is for me personally. And I realised for the first time that I personally was a sinner, that I personally needed to trust in the Lord Jesus, that he died on the cross for me. And that happened to me, and I really was like my eyes being opened, because I hadn't grasped that before, personal salvation. And that was just a year or about a year before I went up to university. And I hadn't really thought about the creation issue, not until really I started beginning to do my career, which started in mathematics. So I've come quite a long way from there, obviously. I've ended up in an engineering environment. And in the last few years of my full-time work as a professor of thermodynamics at Leeds, I started looking into biomimetics and started studying creatures, you know, which I could learn from with a view to using them in an engineering context. So most people know that I've worked on the bombardier beetle, although I'm not going to talk about that now. At least I don't think I am, unless Robert wants to raise it. But, you know, and clearly, as a person thinking into these issues as a Christian, I became aware, actually, that if the Bible's not true on the first few pages, I might as well dump it for the rest. And I realised that it was a pretty important issue. So I began to think about it quite hard and realised that truth is there in the first few books, and there's no way you can argue really that Genesis is poetry. I know Dennis Alexander argues that, but I can't see that. I think Genesis is history. And I don't want to get involved in the debate, but that then led, we'll debate this later, but then that then led to me realizing, well, I need to understand then how the science fits in. And I tell you, it was a very important moment when I grasped that there really was a global flood. That was the key to unlock the rocks for me. I began to realise that the rocks spoke of catastrophe. And everywhere I've gathered fossils, I love going fossil hunting, I pick them up and they all show evidence to me of rapid burial. So that was the sort of way that I began. And so it became then an issue of understanding the Bible and understanding the science together, and the rest, well, we can talk about as we develop the arguments.
Yeah, and we'll get into this discussion. I mean, one thing that immediately comes to mind, though, I'm sure for many people listening, is you've got a professorship in a respected scientific department of a university.
Yeah.
How does...
I am part-time now,
okay,
I realise.
Right.
3 years ago, I went part-time.
Okay. Has that kind of... the fact that you are... personally, in your beliefs, a young Earth creationist, which has all kinds of, you know, entails all kinds of things about the age of the Earth and so on, cause problems academically for you as people have, you know, obviously disagree with you around that issue?
Some people in the universe don't agree with me and will express it. But in the main, in an engineering department, it doesn't come up a lot.
Mm.
Clearly, if I was in a biology department, I fully realised, it would be an issue. And very, very few people would ever get anywhere in a biology department today because it's biased strongly to an evolutionary paradigm. And obviously, if you're in a geology department, the same would apply. I don't accept their paradigm, but that is a de facto situation.
Mm.
In engineering, though, it doesn't come up a lot, but I maintain that we should actually... talk to biologists, which is what I do in biomimetics, and I respect them. I don't agree with their paradigm, but I learn a lot from the biology, and I see it through engineering lines, which, of course, engineering involves design.
Mm, yeah.
And so there are big issues.
Well, we're going to get into the issues today as we ask this question: does the rock and fossil record speak of Noah's flood or evolution? That's the first question we're asking. And in a couple of weeks' time, we're going to come back for a second show talking about Adam and Eve, death and suffering, and the young Earth creation and evolutionary explanations around that too. So two bites of the cherry for my guest today who joined me on the show, Robert Asher, a paleontologist. He's a Christian, though, and says there's no conflict, as far as he's concerned, between the evolutionary account of Earth's history and Christian faith. Andy McIntosh, as we've just been hearing from Leeds University, a leading British young Earth creationist, doesn't speak on behalf of Leeds University in this capacity, of course, but you'll find him at places like Answers in Genesis and elsewhere, where he writes and blogs and
may
is a
I just
speaker.
Say Truth in Science as well?
Truth in Science, yes, that's
which
something that you've
is,
been very
I'm a co-director
in. Yeah, absolutely. Well, links to both my guests from today's podcast, which you can find as usual at the webpage, that's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Go there if you want to find the links as well to the Facebook and Twitter accounts. You can interact that way. At UnbelievableJB is the Twitter account. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you'd like to give us a comment there on what you thought about today's show. But of course, as ever, you can email in, and I look forward to receiving those and reading some of them out towards the end of the show. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So, the rock and fossil record, that's pretty much what you've devoted your life to, isn't it, Robert? Looking at the rocks, looking at the fossils, seeing whether we can trace an evolutionary story of how
indeed
life developed. So, for you, this is a done deal, I assume, pretty much.
Indeed. If I may briefly, though, comment on what you mentioned a moment ago about the about my view and the no conflict idea between evolutionary biology as one scientific discipline pertaining to the age of the Earth, among other things, and Christianity. The point, my perspective is not that there's no conflict, and Andy sitting next to me has articulated a way in which there is very obviously substantial conflict, and I recognize that. But I guess we'll explore that in the course of the next hour or so.
Yeah.
So in terms of the rock record, I mean, absolutely. You know, you could phrase it along the lines that you must subscribe to an evolutionary paradigm, as Andy mentioned a moment ago, in order to have a job in a biology or sciences department. And I suppose, you know, I suppose that is in general true. But at the same time, you know, you can't be a part of a geography department. You can't be a petroleum geologist, you know, or a cartographer and believe that the Earth is flat, you know. And that's, if you don't mind my saying, I mean, that's pretty much how I view this notion that the Earth is under, is only a few thousand years old. So,
Could I
mean,
yes, if you would like to, go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with that. Obviously, on the cartography and the world being flat, that's a done deal. But on the geology, Andrew Snelling is a well-known geologist who believes in flood geology.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's worked on finding oil and other things in a company without having to subscribe to the millions of years. So what you need, though, is an understanding of where the layers are. And
well,
you need to understand
indeed.
how to get to those layers, and generally it's true that in certain layers you'll find certain things.
Well, tell us so how
I don't think millions of years is essential.
In your view, those layers have been laid down, and what the standard scientific explanation would be for what
Sorry
we find.
Sorry to have interrupted.
No, it's fine.
So I guess it is absolutely true that there's a sequence to Earth history. There's a sequence to geology that you know, naturalists for a couple centuries now have been aware of. And you don't have to connect this to any particular dates. In fact, at the time of publication of The Origin of Species, you know, they really had very little idea as to what the age of the Earth might be. But one of the things that you see in this sequence of fossils, and not to mention inorganic remains, is that humanity occupies a teeny tiny little slice of a teeny tiny little fraction of the uppermost crust. There's a famous metaphor that Mark Twain made in the 19th century about, you know, is it true that the Eiffel Tower was built explicitly to support the uppermost slice of paint at its uppermost spire? And the fossil record of habitually bipedal primates really is kind of like that uppermost bit of paint on the top of the Eiffel Tower. So, yes, no, it's true. You don't need to attribute radiometric dates to any particular part of that sequence to understand the sequence of history that's been deposited over the course of a long time, but you know it's a long time. And what's more, you know that humans have played no role in the vast majority of Earth history simply because of this sequentially laid down series of organic and inorganic remains.
Well, okay. I would dispute that.
Well, obviously. Well, this is what we're here for. So dispute away.
But may I say, I appreciate the courtesy with which Robert is speaking, and I have nothing against Robert personally as I now go into this. No, I think there is nothing proven about whether humans were around in the lower strata, just simply because they occur at the top. I will admit that we don't know quite how the sorting took place, but everything indicates catastrophic burial, and that's what I want to stress. Whenever you look at the layers themselves without the fossils strongly indicate rapidity of deposition.
If I may interject, I mean, I'm sorry, but that, you know, you can look at various deposits the world over and find evidence of catastrophic floods. And one example that comes to mind is an upper Pleistocene lake, a glacial lake called Lake Missoula.
I'm aware of it.
In
the
United
Columbia
States
River
Canada.
Gorge. Yeah.
Indeed. And when, you know, this was dammed by tongues of glaciers to the west, that formed and reformed over the course of centuries, leading to multiple waves, literally, of catastrophic flooding. And so if you're cruising about the Willamette Valley in Oregon and Washington State, you know, hundreds of miles to the west of Lake Missoula, you see, house-sized boulders that have been transported from their parent rocks somewhere in British Columbia or eastern British Columbia or western Montana. So clearly, you can look at in the record and find plenty of instances of high energy deposits. However, at the same time, you know, I grew up and spent formative parts of my life in the central part of New York State, the Finger Lakes region, and you know, the Finger Lakes are glacially carved lakes, for example, that yield meters and meters of finely grained shales. And shale is a fundamentally low energy deposit. You cannot deposit shale, among other things, in the kind of flood that you're talking about that would be of global.
So are you saying
just a minute, it could be consistent though with a runoff event after the flood, what you've just referred to. Missoula, I agree, I've been there and seen it, the Columbia River Gorge and that area, clearly shows rapidity, and I would accept that New York State, I've also been there to the Finger Lakes.
Lovely place.
Beautiful. I'd love, very similar to England, in fact, some of the areas of the Lake District.
You guys have a nicer spring, though.
Yes, I would agree. Yours is a
but our fall is better.
Yeah, I like that. But I spent many a day there. But I would it indicates to me, yes, some glacial effects that you've just been referring to. But I have no problem with that as being possibly a subsequent event.
Fair enough.
In the 100 years or so afterwards, after the flood.
Fair enough.
What I was referring to earlier, if I may just say, is that as you go deep down, for instance, in the Grand Canyon, other places where you could see the layers exposed, they're all indicating horizontal layering of massive proportions. If you look at the Cretaceous rock, which is much further down than we've just been referring to, it indicates massive deposition.
For those who are simply not already au fait with the arguments for and against in this issue of the deposition of rocks and whether that suggests a long period of laying down or a catastrophic flood that might tie in with Noah's flood, the fact that there are multiple layers that have been laid down, how does that work with the young earth creationist view?
Well,
because when we think of a flood, we think a one-time event.
Let me bring in something from my own area, because I've for quite a bit of my research, I was not looking at the origin, but I was looking at the burning of coal, right? So it's to do with combustion, obviously, in my area. And it's astonishing the amount of high-rank coal that there is in Pennsylvania, in the States, in our country, in Derbyshire, obviously, until a famous lady stopped us all minding it. But, you know, coal is ubiquitous right across the world, and there's some very high-rank coal. High-rank means high carbon content. Now, to get high-rank coal, you've got to have stopped the air getting into the vegetation from which coal is made. Huge trees, other vegetation has been buried. To get that, you can't bury it slowly. You've got to bury it fast, because otherwise the stuff just acts like your compost heap at the bottom of the garden, and it deteriorates, degenerates, and the amount of carbon, although there'll be some left, will be more like peat, not like high-rank coal in Pennsylvania, Derbyshire and other places, Yorkshire, of course. And so that indicates immediately to me massive burial, and I'm not yet talking of the fossils, but the actual layers where they've got carbon in, obviously got the carboniferous layers, but you've also got many other layers, Permian layers, which have coal in them. This indicates strongly to me they were buried rapidly. In Australia, in the southern part of Australia, you get, in some areas, miles thick coal. We don't have it to that extent here. Mm. That, again, is indicating rapid burial of all that.
Okay, well, let's come to Robert for some responses.
Sure. I mean, there are several things that your audience has just heard, and I'm really left kind of speechless, but I'll try my best. Right, so at the base of the Grand Canyon, one of the things that you see is a steeply dipping a series of rocks that when dipping, by dipping I mean they're not horizontal, they've been clearly altered tectonically, and so that they're quite steep. Your listeners who've been to the Isle of Wight, of course, if you've ever visited the Needles, you see a similar phenomenon. Of course, those rocks are much younger than those at the base of the Grand Canyon. To argue that dip is somehow the product of a global flooding event, whether it's catastrophic an initiation followed by, a gradually decreasing amount of energy subsequent to that is rather absurd. And the other point that's worth mentioning in this context is that it's not simply that you see it's not at all the case that you see one catastrophic event followed by lower energy depositions. What you actually see in the fossil record And you don't need to go to the Grand Canyon. Actually, the United Kingdom is the birthplace of geology. And from the Isle of Wight to Hutton's Unconformity, I mean, this country is very rich in the degree to which the pages of Earth history are evident to us. What you see are multiple waves, thousands and thousands of repeated phases of low energy deposition followed by something more high energy, and you could tell the difference very easily because a shale with low energy deposition is all, you know, it's all about very fine grain minerals, the fine grain particles that are slowly falling to the bottom of a lake, for example. And then, you know, in the, well, to go back to the Finger Lakes, where I know a bit better than the UK, you know, you can find intercalated with that units of limestone, mudstone, other sorts of units that in which the energy changes. So this idea that you had a flood that took place over the course of a week, Creation Week in Genesis 1, I suppose. You'll articulate that more fully, if I may finish.
Sorry, the flood is longer than that.
Okay, 40 days, 40 nights, I guess.
Well, it's a whole year.
Fine. Okay, 1 year. I mean, you're clearly taking events that on any rational investigation that any rational member of a mainstream with a mainstream geological education just cannot pack that into a single year. And the other point to make here is that, of course, global events leave global traces. I mean, we have a geological record for truly global events, and perhaps the one that your audience will know most, will be most familiar to your audience, is this asteroid impact that evidently hit the planet about 65 million years ago, or at least, you know, forgetting the radiometric dates for a moment, just at the end of the Cretaceous. And that actually left behind a globally detectable trace of an element called iridium. And immediately adjacent to that so-called iridium spike is a fern spike, reflecting the way in which the habitats, the ecologies of the world reacted to this prolonged period of nuclear winter following the...
But
the
you have no Kubali. Similar global Indeed. Evidence of a global flood, even though you've got
Correct.
Pockets where you've got catastrophic evidence.
That's right. Floods with very, very high energy happen very frequently in the course of the geological record, but they're not the same event.
We are going to let Andy come back on that. We'll let Andy come back on that, but we're already at the end of our first part of our show.
Okay.
Time flies by. And so we'll hear Andy's response to my other guest, Robert Asher, on today's show. We're talking about the rock and fossil record. Does it speak of Noah's flood or evolution? Well, arguing that it speaks on behalf of Noah's flood is Andy McIntosh today. He's a leading British young earth creationist. Robert Asher is saying, no, the rock and fossil record are firmly in the evolutionary camp. And he's a paleontologist, curator at the Museum of Zoology in Cambridge, and says that as a Christian, he doesn't find personally a conflict between the evolutionary account of life and his faith. And you can read more about that in his book, Evolution and Belief. You can join me as well in a couple of minutes' time as we continue this discussion here on Unbelievable on evolution and young earth creationism. We'll be back in a couple of minutes' time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And we've got a really interesting subject for you today, one that I know always provokes a lot of reaction when we do it. Young Earth Creationism and Evolution is the first of two shows, in fact. You can hear the second one in a couple of weeks' time. But today on the show, I've got Andy McIntosh, who's a young earth creationist, joining me as we talk about whether the rock and fossil records speak of Noah's flood or evolution. Robert Asher is a paleontologist and curator at the Museum of Zoology in Cambridge, and he's joining me today to discuss this issue. He disagrees strongly with Andy's conclusions, and we've been hearing already in the programme about the different ways they view the way that the rock layers have been laid down. Andy says it all happened in a catastrophic event that is synonymous with the flood of Noah's day. Robert Asher says, no, we see different kinds of things happening in the rock levels. Well, we're going to be returning to that in a moment's time. I've also got a couple of questions you sent in as well when I announced that we'd be doing this today. And so we'll see if we can squeeze in a couple of questions to our guests as well during the course of the show. If you want to interact, you want to give your thoughts on what's happening today, what our guests are saying, then do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll try to read out some of your comments in future shows. Don't forget as well, we're online. You can find details for both my guests and today's show as a podcast at premier.org.uk/ Unbelievable, and links there, of course, for the Facebook page and the Twitter account too. Okay, coming back to this discussion then, gentlemen, I know that every point will want to be contended, sort of rebutted between you both on the course of the show, but I mean, one of the key things, I think, Andy, that people will immediately point to, regardless of the details of how and when these things were laid down, is radiometric dating settles the case as well. We've got scientific ways of showing how old stuff is now, and lots of it is obviously more than 6,000 years old, which is presumably the kind of ballpark figure you're aiming at with how old, by and large, the Earth is.
I think, can I just say one thing before I come to radiometric dating? I wanted to stress not only the rapidity of the deposition of the rocks, but also the rapidity of the deposition of the fossils. For instance, you get in Carboniferous rock, you get dragonflies. And they're reputed to be 230 million years old. You tend to get them much higher up, generally, but there are some which go way back to the Carboniferous. And you certainly, when you get to the rock which is supposed to be 50 million years ago, you get butterflies, recognisable as butterflies. And they're all indicating, I'm just particularly homing in on flight, because flight is something that I've really studied in depth. I haven't done all the study that's that Robert's done on other mammals, on mammals. So I tend to look at the things which are flying. But those creatures indicate rapid burial. You can even see the scales in the dragonflies in the famous video clip of David Attenborough. Wonderful series that he does. I mean, I don't agree with his conclusions, but he shows the facts of wonderful scaled large dragonflies, where you can see even the minute detail of the wing. It indicates smack. It must have happened suddenly while it was still alive.
May I say something?
You're welcome, Robert. That's what you're here for.
Very good. Thank you so much. So the rapidity of fossil deposition, we heard a hand clap indicating that dragonfly being smacked into its earthly grave. I mean, one of the reasons why you get very, very good preservation in localities like the Green River, Eocene, Wyoming, or this Lake Messel in Germany, has to do actually with a very low energy of deposition. I mean, the speed at which that happened, sure. I mean, that, you know, the scenario that paleontologists envision in the case of a primate fossil or a hedgehog fossil or a hedgehog-like fossil that you find at the base of Messel, which also includes things like termites and pangolins and a very wide variety of animals. The speed isn't so crucial, but the energy implicit in the Green River deposits, in the Eocene deposits at Messel, is incredibly low. And the notion that you have global floodwaters depositing a butterfly in the Green River or Messel or wherever. That's absurd, Andy. That's absolute nonsense. I'm terribly sorry.
It's not absurd, if I may so say.
But think of a tidal wave depositing a butterfly. What is going to happen to that butterfly?
Robert, just
fair enough. Go ahead.
Just, if I may just interject, but thank you for your point. I don't think you should use the word absurd. I think that's going too strong. What I'm saying is that the indication from the fossil itself, even a fish, by the way, you referred to the Green River Formation, which is mainly fish, but there are other things there, as you rightly said. But the indications of all the fossils, I maintain, is rapidity of squeezing. They've got to have been alive while they were being crushed. And that's the only way you could get a dragonfly wing imprinted onto the mud.
Well, you know, I'm
and
willing
that's
to
all
accept,
I was arguing for.
You
now,
know
how that happened, whether it was mud coming in from a massive wave or whatever it was, I don't know.
I guess what I'm saying, Andy, is that the energy implicit in the kind of geological activity you're suggesting contradicts the quality of the specimen
that is
articulated
before
our eyes.
You cannot.
I submit
that
to the fair-minded listeners talking. We've just witnessed.
Well, Robert, with all respect, I would also appeal to your listeners. Just look at the fossils. When I go to Port Mulgrave on the northeast coast near Whitby, I pick up the ammonites, and they're all higgledy-piggledy, obviously buried rapidly. Everything it's telling you in the Jurassic, in that case, it was buried very, very quickly.
So what you're saying is that, say, Paleozoic deposits, rocks that are very old, you're saying that the energy was very high then, and then once you get later in the Cenozoic it's lower? Is that?
I'm not prepared to say how fast. Right. All I'm saying is we would have to go further into detail to actually work out how fast the flows were. I'm just simply saying that the fossil itself indicates that it was crushed while it was still alive.
We're obviously going to not come to an agreement on this, and we'll leave that issue there just for a moment. I would like to get to radioactive dating. Radiometric dating even. Because again, this would be an area where most scientists, I assume, would be happy. I don't know how much this actually comes into your area of science.
Very little.
Very little. But geologists generally, presumably, do measure the age of rocks, not just by where they occur in the strata, but using radiometric dating. Now, you're happy with that, as a scientific way of measuring the age of rocks and when they sort of...
Indeed, yeah, of course. One of the important things to realize about radiometric dating is that, these are various isotopes that have a predictable rate of decay. Some of them are relevant to very young ages, like carbon-14. Others have a much longer half-life and can be used throughout most of Earth history. But this came into widespread application middle of the 20th century. It's a fairly recent development. And again, the problems about relative sequence of the record, and I do hope we'll talk at some length about the tree of life and how that corresponds with actually what we find in the record, because that's a very, but all of this is independent. All of this is completely independent of radiometric dates. And so my interests are along the lines of what kind of data can we use to build the tree of life, and in particular, how can we represent fossils in the tree of life. I'm sort of an armchair consumer of radiometric dates that the geologists publish. But, of course, it's a very impressive record, and it's not, so let's take carbon-14, right? Carbon-14 is completely irrelevant for the various groups in which I'm interested in, which tend to be the earlier part of the Cenozoic and the Cretaceous. But it's very relevant not only to it's relevant to deposits that are roughly within the last 50,000 years because it has a very short half-life compared to other isotopes. Now, it just so happens that we have annual accumulations of Earth sediment in phenomena like tree rings in Antarctic or polar ice cores. We have cave deposits in parts of the Caribbean, in Europe, in Japan. We have lake deposits that record more or less undisturbed thousands of years. There's a particular lake in Japan that has over 50,000 years of continuous deposition at the bottom. And, of course, I suspect that Andy is, he will rightfully note that there is ambiguity about using radiometric elements. And so, for example, the ratio of carbon-14 to its daughter isotope has not been stable over time. That has changed, and a scientist who's interested in extracting information out of that has to take that into account. But what we have with VARV chronologies, with this lake deposit in Japan, actually, I have in my pile here a paper that I can share if you guys are interested, but what we have is completely independent of this ticking of a radioactive isotope with which we can deposit archaeological materials.
Independently, it's consistent with an old age of the rocks and the deposits and so on.
Precisely.
And
not only that, but there are events in recorded human history, the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in the first century, for example, that actually shows up in ice core and tree ring dendrology. And you can use that because we know that was roughly around AD 70. Am I right, Vesuvius?
Somewhere,
corresponding with when the Romans burned down the temple, I think.
Very, very
Although
close
the two things
that.
Apparently have nothing to do with each other. I guess you guys will enlighten me if I'm wrong. But
we'll go there.
But
all right. Well, we understand what you're saying. So it's not an area that you particularly tends to come into your work, but it certainly complements it. It's consistent with what you see in the way that in your area you can account for the age of these deposits and so on. Okay, so what's the standard response to this aspect of...
Robert's already admitted that in order to be sure on the carbon dating, you've got to know how much CO2 of that particular type, that particular isotope, was in the atmosphere when the creature died, and of course you don't know that. So we have to be very careful about deductions using any radiometric dating, by the way. That always applies. You don't know how much of the parent element and daughter element were there to begin with. There are various ways around that, you hope, but it's not easy to do it. And plus the fact that the rate of decay may also be up for grabs, although with carbon-14 dating, as Robert's rightly said, it is only valid for, at the very most, 100,000 years. You wouldn't really be able to use it beyond that.
Sure.
Now, I obviously think that it's much less than 100,000 years maximum, but just for the time being, let's look at the broad issue, which is people are claiming that the rocks are laid down over millions of years. Carbon-14, even if it were the case that the CO2 carbon-14 levels were the same today as they were in the past, right, which is...
No one makes that argument. We are perfectly aware that it hasn't been.
Okay, yeah, but we both agree that that's a debatable point. But
it's not debatable that we can use varve chronologies or lake deposits to infer what that ratio would have been 20, 30, 40,000 years ago.
Yeah, we don't know.
Well, we do know. I mean, we know how old the bottommost layers in Lake Chisholm.
Let me come to my point. Whatever that level is, right, it's significant that carbon-14 is found in coal, right, which is meant to be millions of years old, according to the dating by other schemes, right? We find carbon-14 is significant also in fossilised wood. We've even got reports coming in of carbon-14 being found in dinosaur bones, actually dating the bone directly using a carbon-14 system. Now, that is yet to be confirmed by those who would disagree with our position, and I accept that people are still furiously debating this data.
No one's debating the idea there's a terrestrial theropod in the mesic that is, 20,000 years old. No one is debating that except for this minority of young creationists.
No, but we're talking about dinosaurs, right? Now, dinosaurs are meant to have died out 65 million years ago.
Terrestrial dinosaurs. Birds are dinosaurs.
We're talking about triceratops.
Fair enough. Yes,
okay. Right. Now, Triceratops is meant to have died out 65 million years ago in the event that was described earlier
by
Robert.
If we're finding carbon-14, that would suggest
actually these creatures were not millions of years old. That's my major point. Now, the rest of it concerning whether it's 100,000 or whether it's 50,000 or 5,000 is all to do with how you calibrate
the carbon-14
system.
But it throws the whole thing into question.
That's
for
what
you.
I'm saying.
That's the
big
point.
Picture is that it throws the whole lot into question.
Well, let's talk about dinosaurs because we've got a paleontologist with us. I mean,
who doesn't study dinosaurs? But keep going.
Yeah, well,
that's what everyone thinks when you say paleontologist, isn't it?
Well, I'm striving to change that, but I'm not really succeeding in any way.
All right, but you obviously, when you look at a kind of strata of rocks going back, you see millions of years there, Robert. You don't see something less than 6,000 years old, certainly.
Correct.
And as far as you're concerned, as you've already said, there's some ambiguity over certain aspects of radiocarbon dating, but the general consensus is thoroughly consistent with what you see as the scientific consensus on how these layers were laid down.
The paleontologists of the 19th century who had never heard of carbon dating, and by the way, again, carbon dating is completely irrelevant for the vast majority of life history. We use other isotopes like potassium argon or argon argon.
But it's not irrelevant if you find it in the bones.
You don't find it in the bones.
But you do.
Well, what you're doing, Andy, if I may, is you're picking up on various odd results that you can immediately get. It is isolated, frankly. I mean,
not in the coal. It's all over the world.
Okay, look. If we look at the actual stratigraphy, as we were talking about a moment ago, and 100 years before anyone conceived of radiometric decay, there was no question that you have vast expanses of time, and you don't need to observe carbon-14 degrading into some other isotope in order to... I know you do, but what can I tell you?
How'd you get high-rank coal, Robert?
We'll leave that to one side.
Coal has formed on many occasions over the, at different points in Earth history.
It must be fast.
We're going to leave that, because what I really want to come to is the larger point, which is what you study, Robert, which is what you call seeing the tree of life in that rock record. For you,
very important,
you see... in the types of fossils you get in each rock record, the a kind of a picture, a diagram of sure. the evolution of life over millions of years.
Indeed.
So for you, that must be central in this whole issue, right?
Absolutely, and I would be remiss if I were to not mention at this juncture another line of evidence in regards to the antiquity of the Earth that has to do, and I'll get to the Tree of Life in a moment, but seafloor spreading, right? So what we have as paleontologists is an array of lines of evidence that we, of course, take advantage of. And seafloor spreading refers to the fact that New York and London are slowly but surely becoming farther apart as we are having this conversation. When I was born, London and New York were slightly closer together. I don't think that would have made much of a difference in the flight time, but they were closer together. And not only that, but, of course, what I'm getting at is plate tectonics, right?
Mm-hmm. The fact that the
continents are mobile. The people who discovered plate tectonics, the scientists who did the work to drill cores in the Atlantic seafloor on either side of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, what they found was that the Earth's polarity, the North Pole and the South Pole, has switched repeatedly over the course of Earth history. And basically what happens is that polarity is recorded by certain kinds of rocks that are recoverable from a core from the Atlantic seafloor. And what you find on either side of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge is that they're mirror images of each other. Just imagine a UPC code, which is the way in which magnetochrons are represented, right? You have a white for normal and black for reversed, arbitrarily focused on the north and south that we know today. What you see on either side is this UPC code is a mirror image of each other on either side of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. So to make the argument that somehow that seafloor spreading has occurred within 10,000 years is another one of these extraordinary claims.
Let me explain, if
I may finish, I mean, it's not simply that the magnetochrons are reversed on either side of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. It's that the fauna, the flora in the rock record in the parts of West Africa and the angular part of Brazil, for example, the Triassic faunas that we see in South Africa and Brazil, they're very, very similar and speak to the fact that these continents were actually together.
Yeah, and so the point is, we know how slowly the continents are moving now.
Correct.
And for those same things to be on both those things and to have moved so far apart suggests that they must have been there put there millions of years ago.
No, that's
okay, but you disagree.
That's an overlay, which is an interpretation.
Okay.
Now take the same data,
okay,
and it fits beautifully with tectonic splitting at the flood. We don't quite know what caused it. It may have been an impact. We don't know the cause, or it may have been from under the earth. But certainly the continent split. I fully accept that. And certainly I look at the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And certainly Robert's absolutely right. He described it beautifully concerning the polarity changing either side. As the rock was oozing out and crystallizing, yes, it reflected the polarity at that moment. But that indicates, and this would fit, that there was a massive upheaval in the centre of the Earth in terms of the sloshing of the inner core.
Mm.
And the inner core was heavily disturbed. This would fit with the evidence, which isn't so much the rocks, but people have recorded in other cultures that there was something weird happening in their days and in their nights. Things were not just let me finish, Robert, if I may. And that there was something chaotic happening. Right.
Okay.
So now just looking at the rocks themselves, the rocks are actually showing the rapid change of the polarity as they spread out. America split from Europe and there was no America or Europe before. Everything was fossilized by the deposits of the flood. So the fauna on both sides is similar. No problem. And they split away fast. Now it's decayed and changing to India. India is now still pushing up against the rest of Asia, pushing up the Himalayas, but the Himalayas weren't formed slowly.
Okay.
They were formed fast.
Listen, right, really briefly. So Banda Aceh, right, the tsunami that wiped out the rims of the human cultures and the rims of the Indian Ocean back in 2004, that was as a result of a very subtle movement between tectonic plates.
We're not talking about that.
It is relevant because you've just said the cultures who were around at the time recorded something funny.
No, not at the time. I'm talking about those people who lived afterwards.
Recorded human history goes back about 11,000 years.
Those people who lived afterwards recorded that things.
There would not have been any people around.
No, they were recording.
The kind of energy you're talking about would vaporize
Earth. You misunderstood
itself.
Me. You misunderstood me.
If a tectonic plate is skating around at a couple kilometers per year, it just, there's nothing
you misunderstood
that
me,
life
Robert.
On Earth could do to resist.
If I may just correct,
all right, okay.
Robert thinks that I'm referring to people living through it. There was nobody who lived through it. He's absolutely right. But Noah's family, right, knew some of the things that took place. Some of it's recorded, of course, in Genesis, but other cultures have recorded some of the things which were experienced after the flood, right, where things were still settling down and people were aware of massive changes in the way the Earth was behaving.
Obviously, again, it's a very different interpretation using the data. Obviously, you believe, Andy, that this was something that happened quickly and then sort of we now witness a slow movement.
Yeah, I'm
of the
sorry
continents.
If I gave the wrong impression. Robert's absolutely right.
Yeah, but Robert, obviously,
nobody lived through
that doesn't make sense to Robert. You obviously feel that you have to look at this as something that's happened over millions of years. I would like to get, because we're rapidly running out of time just in the second half of the programme, to talk a little bit at least about the actual records we find in those strata, because presumably what you see, and I speak here as a layperson, is a sort of gradual complexity emerging as you look over the range of vertebrate life that you see
I'd phrase it a bit differently. The term gradual is something that crops up in these kinds of debates a lot, and it doesn't really help at all. But broadly speaking, I think you're articulating something with which I would agree, namely that you don't find rabbits in the Devonian, right? You don't find a parrot in the Ordovician. You don't – the kinds of animals that any one of your listeners can look out of his or her window right now, a flowering plant, a beetle, a hedgehog, a rodent, a bipedal human, some more bipedal than others. but these kinds of – this kind of fauna that exists today – is a particular combination of things that took a long time to get here. I guess to articulate this tree of life more broadly, I think it's very informative to look at what our colleagues in the 19th century were thinking about. And what you see by naturalists such as Theodore Gill, Thomas Henry Huxley, Ernst Haeckel, all of these individuals are interested in drawing trees of life and saying, well, where does a lungfish belong? Is a lungfish somewhere close to a tuna? Is it close to a shark? And when you think about the different ways in which you could construct a tree of life, like a bifurcating rooted tree, the number increases in an extraordinarily fast manner. So the number of potential bifurcating rooted trees for no more than 60 or 70 species is a colossally large number. So in other words, if you were to say, well, am I going to put that chimpanzee next to Homo sapiens, or am I going to put it somewhere next to an orangutan? Am I going to take cats and dogs and put them together? So what you see in the 19th century are people starting to come to grips with an evolutionary understanding of biodiversity. And Theodore Gill, for example, said, well, I think our cartilaginous fish, our skates and rays and sharks, belong in a group by themselves, and they're the sister group to the bony fish. I think that the lungfish is closer to tetrapods, things like amphibians and birds and mammals, than it is to, say, a rayfin fish, a salmon or a tuna. And here we are 100, 20, 30, 40 years later, and what we know about the stratigraphic record is quite decisive. Like I said, you don't find rabbits in the Devonian. You find vertebrates in older strata than you find jawed fish. You find tetrapods in younger strata than you find those jawed fish. If you take, to arbitrarily orient oneself in the tree of life, pick humans, it's no accident that you don't find fossils of Australopithecus on the Isle of Wight. The Isle of Wight is an extraordinary place. It's only, a few dozen square kilometers, yet you have Cretaceous through Oligocene deposits. And when you're walking on that southwestern beach, you don't see, for example, habitually bipedal primates, except the ones that are collecting the fossils. I hope I've made this point that there's correspondence.
Even though I didn't understand
the notion in the tree of life,
all of the anatomy terms that you used. I get the general point, which is that...
There's a really great book out there that describes those terms in a bit more detail.
Yes, indeed. It's the one you've written, I think, is the one you're talking about. But
can I reply?
But yeah, well, let's do that. I mean, in fact, we're just coming to the end of this section, so I'll allow you a chance to respond in the as we start to wrap up the program in the next section, rather than run over now. Forthright debate today on the show. Andy McIntosh, Young Earth creationist, is with me, and you were just hearing from Robert Asher, who's a paleontologist and author of the book he mentioned, Evolution and Belief: Confessions of a Religious Paleontologist. We're debating the question of whether the rock and fossil records speak of Noah's flood or evolution today, and I still haven't managed to put any of your questions to my guests either, so I'll try and do that as well, just as we start to wrap things up in the next section of the programme. This is Justin Brierley with another interesting and hopefully getting you thinking, at least, edition of Unbelievable, wherever you stand on this debate on evolution and young earth creationism. We'll be back in just a moment's time. Welcome back to the third and final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon with me, Justin Brierley. We've been getting lots of feedback to the last few weeks of programming, and so sit tight if you want to hear some of that towards the end of today's programme, where you can hear some of that in about 10 minutes' time. Come back again, of course, for more discussion at the same time next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon at 2:30. And I'll also be filling you in on some interesting programming changes happening on Saturday afternoons. Unbelievable, of course, will still be here at the usual time of 2:30, but there's some other programmes that we're going to be adding to the schedule around Unbelievable for thinking Christians. So that's very exciting, and we'll fill you in a bit more about that same time next week. For now, we're going back to the final part of our discussion between Andy McIntosh and Robert Asher. Let's just bring you up to speed with what we've been talking about so far.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So our discussion question today has been, does the rock and fossil record speak of Noah's flood or evolution? Andy McIntosh, who's a professor of thermodynamics at the University of Leeds and a leading young earth creationist, has been arguing that, well, you can take the same data and put it in the framework of a young earth creationist perspective when it comes to the age of the earth and the flood and so on. Robert Asher, though, strongly disagrees with that. He's a paleontologist, author of Evolution and Belief, and he says that simply the overwhelming consensus of the scientific record is that we live on an ancient Earth where these rock and fossil deposits were put down over millions of years. And just in that last section, Andy, Robert was making the case that the Tree of Life, if you like, supports this whole aspect. You look at the what kinds of animals you find in the various strata, and you'll find that they correspond to sort of particular times in the evolutionary story and so on. And you don't find one animal from one time mixed in with another animal of another time and so on. So, OK, chance to respond.
OK, it's certainly true that you tend to find mammals to the top, and I accept that, but there are some notable instances. For instance, I tend to be looking at birds and flight much more. That you find, as I said earlier, that dragonflies are virtually identical to modern dragonflies, and that's a span over supposedly 200 million years, and I don't accept the dates at all because of what I said about carbon-14 in coal. Everything's measured in thousands of years, not millions of years. Rapid deposition, but that's my position. But even taking Robert's position, you've got dragonflies there very similar to today. And when you look at birds, you've got... Recently, there's an article which has shown in the early Jurassic, late Triassic. It's a bit debatable as to what the Santo Domingo deposits are in Argentina. But you've got what clearly looks like the footprints of birds, right? And this is way before the supposed ancestry to birds in Archaeopteryx, a bit later in the Jurassic, and other things at the Liaoning shales in China. So there is a lot of evidence, actually, which would, I accept, not be easy to explain to do with why we tend to get mammals to the top and reptiles to the bottom, further down. But nevertheless, there are notable exceptions.
So there are exceptions.
Yeah, there are exceptions. And... But let me now come to my crucial point, and that's this. The supposed Tree of Life is really in the imagination of those who are trying to interpret the evidence. Classification is not the same as proof of common descent. You can classify creatures very well, which has been done by the biologists. I have no problem with their classification system. But that doesn't prove common descent. And when it comes to birds, there are notable things in birds which really just cannot have evolved. To try and suggest that a reptile's scale has changed into a feather is, to be frank, aerodynamic nonsense. It just cannot have happened, because you're dealing here with such intricate mechanisms. This is just one aspect of a bird, right? Feathers. To get the interlocking barbules, which are only visible under the microscope, and there are literally hundreds of thousands of these tiny little interlocking barbules, which the posterior ones are different to the anterior ones. The anterior ones have hooks on, and the posterior ones effectively have ridges on. And they've even got hinged grips on these tiny little barbules, which come off the barbs, which, and the barbs, of course, come off the main rachis of the feather. Now, I could go into great detail about a feather. People know that I lecture on aerodynamics, lecture on birds.
I'd like to go into some detail on feathers, too.
To suggest, as mainline paleontologists have been suggesting, all except Fiducia, who believes it happened some other way, but to suggest that scales changed into feathers is nonsense.
What is nonsense, Andy, is your characterization that you made right now, that an evolutionary view of continuity of birds within theropod dinosaurs depends on the transition of a scale into a feather, because that's simply not true. The fact is that ectodermal structures like teeth, hair, feathers, scales, we don't argue that there was an iguana 150 million years ago that turned into a bird. What Andy has just made here is the so-called crocoduck fallacy. He holds up a picture of a crocodile, thinks the paleontologists are saying, well, you said that
some
scales
reptile.
Turned into feathers.
Some reptile.
I think in the course of reading some of your this book that you sent around to secondary schools throughout the UK, for example, I have the impression that you're getting some of your information from a biologist by the name of Richard Prum. He's an evolutionary biologist at Yale University in the U.S., and he's been very critical about the idea that a scale turns into a feather. This is not because he thinks that, you know, it was somehow deus ex machina and a feather appeared out of nothing. It is because he thinks that there's a common integumentary pattern, ectodermal keratinous, from which the common ancestor of something like an iguana that exists today and a feather today.
That's
so,
a fair
Andy,
summary.
No one's making the argument. Well, let me phrase that more carefully. You will find in the paleontological literature people talking about the homologies between scales and feathers. And actually, there are homologies between scales and feathers. There are alpha and beta keratins.
But they're not from a common ancestor. I don't accept that.
Well, you know, I know you
it's
don't accept
it.
It's not
from the way of,
you know, if
the
you
way
take
of feather.
The weight of the evidence.
No, but this is.
Then it really is an inescapable conclusion that, you know, you do have common ancestry.
No, may I just interject
yes,
there?
Go ahead.
I know we haven't got long, but may I interject, Robert? You see, it's the detail, Robert, which shows you the fallacy of this idea of common descent.
The fact that feathers weren't for flying.
Incontrovertible
evidence.
If animals
that had feathers that weighed over a ton.
Robert,
Majungatholus crenitismus
Robert,
from the Late Cretaceous Madagascar.
Let me just finish my point.
We are drawing close on time, so one minute to finish that point, and then we'll let Robert come back.
You see, it's true that superficially the scale is to do with the integument.
It's more than superficial.
Let me just finish my point. Superficially, there it may be some similarity that it's to do with the skin and the integument description that Robert just gave. But actually, the follicle of a feather is a marvellous device, because the feather grows from the base of the follicle, right? And it pushes out, and with the keratin all in place of this remarkable structure, which then comes out of the keratin sheath, which is nothing like what happens with the scale.
Okay.
Of a
so
dinosaur.
You're saying they're too different to be connected
totally
in any way. Okay. Response, Robert,
yeah,
and then
well,
we'll...
I mean, the idea that Andy is, you know, is expressing a level of admiration, which I share, about the relative complication of feathers. And, you know, you're I gave you a bit of a hard time there, Andy. I recognize that. I mean, I guess that's what we're here for. I guess that's what we're here for. But the barbules that support different axes along a central rachis. I mean, that is complicated. It's true.
It's hugely complicated.
But you know, Andy, listen, a bird chick does not have flight feathers. These flight feathers are things that develop over the course of an individual ontogeny. And the individual ontogeny is actually what we see. So Prum, I mentioned a moment ago, developed a hypothesis without the paleontological support in the early 90s that what we should expect to find in the fossil record are adult dinosaurs, adult terrestrial theropod dinosaurs, if birds did indeed evolve from them, that exhibit phenotypes that we see during the development of a living bird, and we do. And the name is Bipiaosaurus. If Justin lets me post links, I can provide this reference. Norell and Shu, 2005, Annual Review of Ecology and Systematics. The description of a late Jurassic form of Bipiaosaurus wasn't discovered in 2008. But this is an adult animal that shows type 1 feathers that weren't for flight, but you can use it for insulation.
Okay, so that's all you find.
All right. Well, so you're making the case for sort of transitional fossils that show that there were...
Which are unmistakable.
They are extinct birds, or else they're not birds at all.
Okay. The definition of bird requires a list of characters. Feathers, air sacs, flow-through lungs. And the fact is, this list of characteristics, feathers, flow-through lungs, air sacs, shows up piecemeal in the fossil record. You have animals that didn't fly.
If it's got feathers, it's a bird.
Like Archaeopteryx, for example.
We're going to have
a supracoracoides muscle either. And you know that.
I do know that.
Well, you're just making stuff up now.
I'm going to have to interrupt. I know that we could go on debating the finer points of the birds and feathers for a long time.
Hey, Justin's cutting us both off.
I am cutting you both off because we're going to be back in a week's time. And if there are leads that we have to pick up, we can do it then. It's been fascinating. I haven't even managed to get to the question, so I'm gonna save that over for a couple of weeks' time. The one about how did all the animals fit on the ark that Gordon asked, and hopefully a few more as well for next week. Okay, it's been fun. It's been pretty feisty. Is one way of putting it towards the end of today's show.
Nice alliteration, fun and feisty.
Fun and feisty. But obviously, gentlemen, you hold very different views on this. I never expected you to come to any kind of agreement on the show, but certainly you've laid out your different positions very well. And so what we're going to do is we're going to call a truce for the moment, come back in 2 weeks' time, and you can hear Andy McIntosh and Robert Asher continue this conversation from a little bit of a different perspective. We've done a lot of the science today. Next time we're going to be talking about some of the theological issues maybe that come out of our view of the fossil record, whether humans are a product of a long evolutionary history, and so on. Okay, so that's all to come next time. For the moment, gentlemen, let me say thank you for joining me on the show today.
Thank you, Justin.
Great to have you with me.
Many thanks to you.
Thank you, Robert, for coming on as well.
And thanks to Robert as well, my partner.
Well, indeed. Thanks
indeed.
To you.
And I will, of course, post links to where you can find out more about Robert's book, Evolution and Belief, where you can find out more about Andy McIntosh's sort of resources and things. Easiest place to visit for all of that is the website of the show. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Posting that all up with the podcast so that you can find your way to those resources. I hope this has got you thinking. It certainly has given me lots of food for thought, and we'll be back to back into the debate in a couple of weeks' time. If you enjoyed today's show, why not get in touch? Why don't you tell me what your views are on the issues of the fossil record? unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. And of course, you can get in touch via facebook.com/unbelievablejb to like the page and to get in touch that way. Or if you're a Twitter user, @unbelievablejb is my handle. And I'd be pleased to hear your thoughts about today's programme. We're going to hear some of your feedback now in a moment's time to previous week's shows.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, there's been lots of feedback to the last few weeks of programming. Let me start off, though, with this one from Steve, who emails in to say, I'm a great fan of your show. I often listen to it by podcast while mowing the lawn. Just recently, you mentioned that you may at some point host a show featuring young earth creationism or creationist arguments that deny the reality of evolution. Well, that's obviously what you heard today, Steve, that discussion that I'd mentioned before. You wanted to point me in the direction of a survey conducted recently among ex-Christians on Reddit regarding what they deem to be the greatest obstacles to belief in Christianity and also what they consider to be the greatest reason that ultimately led them to walking away from the faith. What was found was that overwhelmingly ex-Christians are of the opinion that the greatest challenge to Christianity are its teachings that are in conflict with the findings of modern science. I feel that's something that's worth taking into account when it comes to discussing views held by Christians that are out of step with what scientists acknowledge to be true today. And you point me in the direction of the results. You've handily summarised them here as well. 2020 people took part, the majority of which, 73%, were ex-Christians. 54% of those left the faith because of Christian teachings that conflict with the findings of modern science. And 42% of those regard the greatest obstacle to belief in Christianity to be Christian teachings, again, that conflict with findings of modern science. You conclude by saying, interestingly, a mere 14% of Christians regarded the greatest obstacle to belief in Christianity to be Christian teachings that conflict with the findings of modern science. Interesting stuff. Thank you, Steve. Obviously, very relevant to the subject of today's show. Michael, talking of studies, and this is Michael Brady, who emails to say that someone's put together a study on six different types of atheists. He'd like us to see a show on this. You show me the CNN article which talked about this, and quote from it, we do know that the anti-theist category has much in common with religious fundamentalism. Likewise, the intellectual atheism / agnosticism type has a lot in common with intellectual theology, although they're clearly not the same. Very interesting. Six different types of atheist, if you want to look it up. The study site is atheismresearch.com. Let's go to some of your feedback on the show of last week. I had a feature called A Different Kind of Coming Out, where I chatted to three evangelical church leaders who are all same-sex attracted, but have opted not to express that in a same-sex relationship. And we talked about the reasons why they've decided to do that. We also heard on the back of that a discussion between Savvy Hensman of the LGBT Christian movement and Peter Ould, who describes himself as post-gay on the whole issue of same-sex attraction for Christians. Quite a lot of response on the Facebook page. This is the Unbelievable page that you can find on Facebook after I posted up the show there. Joe Fogey says, is there a difference between same-sex attracted and gay? If so, what is it? Well, I don't know if that came through in the feature, but certainly in the Christianity article, which you can find online as well, Joe, the reason I think these guys particularly opt for the term same-sex attracted rather than gay is because they want to move away from some of the baggage that sometimes goes with the terminology of gay. If you want to see the Christianity article that I wrote as an interview with these three guys, then do go to christianitymagazine.co.uk. You can find out more about it there. Moises Fogasa de Bittencourt, which is a fabulous name, says in response to Joe there, just a new coined euphemistic term to define something old, Joe Fogey. Kevin Crawford says, I believe gay has the connotation that someone embraces the actions, to some extent the lifestyle, whereas same-sex attracted refers to someone who feels attraction but doesn't act on it. It's a distinction to emphasise that we're more than just our feelings. We can have self-control over what we do. Rebecca Joy, commenting on this, said, so if someone is heterosexual, might they just be opposite sex attracted and not straight? I don't think so somehow. Being gay is not just about what one does. And whilst we're on the topic, love isn't defined by opposite gender combinations, as some Christians might like to claim. Being gay is the same as being straight. You're just attracted to the same rather than opposite. Joe Bruce, meanwhile, says, I agree, and he's talking to Kevin at this point, which is why I describe myself as same-sex attracted and not gay. This was a terrific show, by the way. Everyone who wants to understand both sides of the issue should listen. So Joe there, a Christian who finds himself same-sex attracted but chooses to remain celibate, I think, in Joe's case. Going on, Dom Mower says, Justin, you have to get Robert A. Gagnon on your show. He's a foremost expert on homosexuality in the Bible. He's done extensive work on the topic. Thank you very much. robgagnon.net is where to go for more on him. And Gavin Chisholm says, excellent interview, Justin. Probably the most refreshing and positive airtime I've heard on this topic for a long time. Congratulations to the three in question for speaking up in courage and truth. And James Croft, who is gay himself, but an atheist in this case, says, an excellent and thoughtful interview, yet so painful to listen to. I fear these poor people are harming themselves, and one of them is almost certainly harming their wife. It's tragic to hear people struggling due to their commitment to a twisted sexual ethic. So those were some of the comments on the Facebook page after I posted the show up of last week there. Others have got in touch via email. Mike says, arguing that polygamy and incest are different issues because they involve a relational power struggle or male dominance is simply a smokescreen put up to escape from dealing with the subject. This is in response to this issue that Peter Auld brought up about whether polygamy and incest aren't equally sort of should be equally available as options if it's just about people fulfilling their desires. And Savvy Hensman responded that those are different issues. Well, Mike sort of feels the same way as Peter on this, says from ancient times to the present, heterosexual marriage has also included power issues. Arranged marriage, class marriage, marriage dowries all derive their origin from male dominance. The point being that consensual, committed and non-threatening relationships of any time kind should be championed by the LGBT cause. So why don't we see this? Well, if homosexuals must be allowed to marry someone of the same sex in order to fulfill their personhood or nature, then surely bisexuals must be allowed to marry two persons of the opposite sex to fulfill their nature. If it's true that the government should not be telling people who they can love, shouldn't the government also be disallowed from telling people how many they can love? The gay marriage argument will always be weak until the LGBT is dealt with honestly and consistently, says Mike in Canada. Jay says, I really enjoyed the programme, mostly because of the post-gay gentleman you had on your show, whereas I felt that Savvy's arguments were very rooted in feelings and preference. I think the biggest hurdle on both sides of this argument is that we need to understand that same-sex attraction is not necessarily a sin, but rather the ongoing approved practice is the sin, much the same way that a bent or attraction to gluttony or lying isn't sinful in and of itself, but the act of living in either is. That's Jay's opinion there. Time to look at, I think, the show from the week before last. The argument from desire. This was going back to a more traditional sort of debate here on the show. A Christian and non-Christian joined me to debate an argument for the existence of God. In this case, it was Peter Kraft, our Christian philosopher, who was arguing from desire. The fact that we desire God actually shows up good evidence for his existence. He was in conversation for that with Richard Norman, an atheist philosopher. John in Johannesburg, South Africa, says, I was dismayed to hear Richard, the atheist philosopher, arguing for naturalistic explanations of our desires, yet dismissing, as he referred to it, a crass kind of reductive materialism when you suggested the idea that personal experiences could be described as just a chemical reaction prompted by a stimulus. Well, it would seem to me to be a major part of the naturalist argument in that it describes the physiological processes underlining the behaviour described by your guests. Take the example of hunger. To propose that the desire for food is evidence of the existence of food is to ignore the fact that hunger presents itself as a physical experience. The contraction of one's stomach muscles and the motivation to consume food is created by a fluctuation of certain hormones. The subsequent consumption results in a move from hunger to satiety, or however you pronounce that, another biological process in which inhibitory signals are activated. So the hunger satiation cycle is therefore explained without having an appeal to a non sequitur assertion. It would be equally non sequitur to posit that we have evidence for beauty merely from the desire to sense beauty, since this too ignores the physiological processes involved in that desire. I would suggest that all that is indicated by a desire for a perfectly loving personal deity is a desire to move from one chemical state to another, an inherent chemical hedonism, if you will, says John. Thank you, John. Bruce says, I very much enjoyed the show, Kraft and Norman, on the argument from desire. And while I ultimately agree with Professor Kraft about God's existence, I've never felt the argument from desire was a particularly strong one to show that existence. To me, it's always just seemed like an argument for more. I see beauty. I want more beauty. I see justice. I want more justice. I see love. I want more love. And then the argument slips in what is, in my opinion, a false assumption. Rather than just saying that this is a proof for the existence of beauty, justice and love as separate qualities, there is a leap to the proposal that there is some figure, God, that embodies all of these good qualities. And that leap seems unjustified by the argument, because those initial desires were for beauty, justice and love, not some figure that embodies all three simultaneously. The argument is also vulnerable to silly constructions. I see pastries. I want more pastries. Does that mean that God is the ultimate pastry? No, it just proves the existence of pastries are more abstractly sweet foods in general. I just want to clarify, I'm not dismissing God, just that there are so many more stronger arguments for his existence. The cosmological argument, the grounding of morality, the historical evidence for the life of Christ, etc. Thank you, Bruce. Obviously, those are the kinds of arguments we do elsewhere on the show. I thought worth picking up on this one, though, the argument from desire. It is an unusual argument in that sense, though not one that hasn't persuaded many people. I think that there's a type of person for whom that argument is quite persuasive, not least, you know, one of the most well-known British apologists of our time, C.S. Lewis, who would say it was a major factor in the way he kind of came to grasp God. Dewey, an atheist again, writing in, says, Peter Kraft says, we yearn for something, so it must exist. It's a natural desire, and all natural desires, like hunger, have an object that will satisfy them. Well, lemmings have that feeling too. It begins with hunger, because there are too many of them, and they migrate in large numbers. I don't know if they know where they're going. Perhaps they think they do. Certainly they must be looking for something. I don't know whether they ever really, as legend says, throw themselves off cliffs in the hundreds of thousands in order to end it all. But I do believe they sometimes cross large bodies of water, or try to in their desperation to get somewhere, and drown because it's too far and they're weak from hunger. Who knows, perhaps there is somewhere over the horizon a place for them to go, but that doesn't mean they'll ever get there. Their yearning leads them nowhere, either because their destination doesn't exist or because it's too far away. Who knows, perhaps the yearning of our species for immortality and for union with God is like the big hunger of the lemmings. That doesn't mean God doesn't exist, but the argument from longing, even if it's right, can't tell us if we'll ever get to him. Thank you very much. Okay, maybe just time for one more. Yeah, just one more. Let's go back to the show where we had two young sort of apologists, both for and against Christianity. This was Callum Miller and Chris Hallquist debating the probability of the resurrection. Phil Church, who's a senior lecturer in biblical studies at the School of Theology, Mission and Ministry at Laidlaw College in New Zealand, says, just finished listening to that discussion, usual high standard to be sure, and I learned lots about probability theory, but I think you let Chris the atheist get away with too much. Let me count the ways. Firstly, it's just not good enough to cite unnamed modern biblical scholars to make the point that the Bible is now considered by most to be unreliable. Well, who are they? Later we discover that he relies mostly on Bart Ehrman, who he considers to be mainstream. Yeah, right. In the Guild of New Testament scholarship, Ehrman is mostly considered to be out on a limb. And you go on to give others who you would be far more interested in citing as mainstream New Testament scholars. Secondly, as for the suggestion that Paul and the New Testament authors were lying, well, that's just nonsense that's long since been discredited. While the claims about the martyrdom of the disciples may be in question, and I haven't read the book he cited yet, there is James, the brother of Jesus, who was a skeptic before the resurrection and became a believer and died for that. How else do you explain Paul's 180-degree turn other than that he encountered Jesus and was convinced that he was alive? His point about Mormonism isn't interesting. Again, it's a single example of a religion beginning with what are likely to be spurious claims, but it's a bit of a leap from that to suggest on that basis that this is the way the world is, and therefore the claims of the early Christians were probably spurious too. Fourth, his reference to the way the world is reminded me of maybe the most significant point Rob Bell made in your recent interview. He commented that we live in a world in which God sometimes intervenes in the lives of people and brings new life. There are countless people in the world who will tell you that they are followers of Jesus because he, the risen Lord, intervened in their lives and transformed them from what they were once to what they are now. That is the way the world is, and that makes the resurrection credible. And fifth, while I'm on the subject of Rob Bell, may I say that some of your listeners frustrate the life out of me. Rob Bell has clearly thought very deeply on some of the issues he's written about, and while we may not all agree with everything he says, we need to give him credit for speaking his opinions. Okay, thank you very much for that email. Good to hear from you, Philip. Thank you for getting in touch. Look forward to more of your emails, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. in regard to today's show topic. And of course, I'd be interested to hear from you on the Facebook and Twitter pages. All of the links and more available from the show page as ever, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Thank you for joining me this week. Do come again at the same time next week. You're unbelievable. Well, I'm still actually waiting for final confirmation that I can broadcast what I'm hoping to be able to broadcast on the podcast next week, which is the first of three conversations between Dr. William Lane Craig and Professor Lawrence Krauss on life, the universe and nothing. The first of their conversations happening in Australia. It's going to be happening in Brisbane. So if you can get along there, if tickets are still available, you can find them by going to lifeuniversenothing.org. But it is the first of three conversations that they'll be having. Lawrence Krauss, a well-known atheist in the USA. William Lane Craig, of course, a well-known Christian philosopher. And so they're going to be talking about the whole issue of whether science contradicts the need for God as an explanation of the universe. A classic sort of debate, but two really well-known people in their field. I'm sure you'll want to come back to listen to that, assuming we do finally get the go-ahead to be able to put it out on the podcast. I guess you'll just have to wait till next week to find out if we did. But if you do want to look into it, and if you're in the Oz and can get along, then do go to lifeuniversenothing.org. There's actually three discussions events that they'll be taking part in over the month of August, so worth checking out. In the meantime, have a great week. I'm Justin Brierley. You've been listening to Unbelievable.